government regulations, which were created to protect employees, are actually hurting them.
Regulation after regulation.
Until the government understands that they have to create an environment suitable for us to keep growing, we're going to stay in this recession a long time.
The federal government has blocked efforts to expand the ride-sharing.
The owners say the restaurant has succumbed to the crush of government regulations.
We have seen an unprecedented explosion of new regulatory activity.
$1.8 trillion. That's how much business
and bus companies to close.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut.
The regulations are...
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep...
Is this really the best we can do?
This is Free Lunch, the podcast of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. All expressions of opinion on this podcast are those of the speakers.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Federalist Society Free Lunch Podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. Visit the RTP website at regproject.org, regproject.org, to subscribe to our newsletter and to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. My name is Devin Westhill. I'm the director of the RTP and the host of the Free Lunch Podcast. This Free Lunch Podcast is about what effects regulatory accumulation has had and can have on business decisions, innovation, and the economy. Specifically, we'll hear about a recent study that examines regulations' effect on business investment choices and consequentially on economic growth. The study was conducted by Duke University professors Bentley Coffey and Pietro Pareto, and our Free Lunch Podcast guest today, Dr. Patrick McLaughlin. Patrick is the director of the Program for Economic Research on Regulation and a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. His research focuses primarily on regulations and the regulatory process. Patrick has testified before Congress and state legislatures, has written op-eds for and has had his research featured in various media outlets, and is the author of more than a dozen peer-reviewed studies and a book entitled The Impact of Federal Regulation on the 50 States, which is available on SSRN. Finally, Patrick created and leads the Reg Data and QuantGov projects, deploying machine learning and other tools of data science to quantify governance indicators found in federal and state regulations and other policy documents. The resulting database is freely available at quantgov.org. That's quantgov.org. In just a minute, I'll turn the floor over to Patrick. Before I do, I want to remind everyone that the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy initiatives, and therefore all expressions of opinion on Free Lunch podcasts are those of our featured speakers. Also, Patrick will take questions after his remarks, so please be prepared with any questions that you might have prior to the start of the Q&A period. Patrick, thank you for joining us today as our Free Lunch Podcast guest. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Devin. It's a pleasure to be on the podcast today. You mentioned the projects, Reg Data and QuantGov, at the end of that. And I think that's a good place to start because in a lot of ways, while we now have data on regulation and the growth of the regulatory state, it's been to some degree hidden for many decades because those innovations, those data weren't available until relatively recently. So let's talk about some statistics, some data about regulation in the regulatory state. First, let me just introduce a term that you may already be familiar with, but just in case you're not, the term is regulatory accumulation. And this is kind of self-explanatory, but it's still shocking when you hear the actual numbers. Regulatory accumulation is just the growth of regulation over time. It's a phenomenon that we have seen at the federal level that we also observe at many state levels in other countries. I think it's a fairly natural phenomenon. I think it's the kind of thing that you see in really any organization that grows. That could be a business, that could be a nonprofit, or that could be a government. But in this case, because the growth of an organization, regulatory agencies, or a set of organizations is associated with the growth in some sort of law, namely regulations, there are consequences outside the organization that are worth dwelling on. So regulatory accumulation is really the starting point for this study. It's why we did this. I remember clear back in grad school, which is a long time ago now, when I first was learning about the growth of regulation and just how large the regulatory state has gotten, it got me wondering, so what sort of effect would the just sheer size of the regulatory state have on economic growth? And I am an economist. It's a pretty natural question, and I was a bit shocked to learn that no one had really adequately addressed that question. So this is the that's the bit of the story behind why this study came about. First, I observed that regulatory accumulation is very real, and the numbers behind it are pretty shocking. We have more and more agencies created over time to the point that now we have well over 200 different named agencies, offices, or departments that are publishing regulations in the Code of Federal Regulations. That's naturally going to lead to a lot of rules being on the books. Once I learned a bit more about those numbers, in particular, and there's another number for you, back in 1970, there were roughly 40,000 pages of regulations on the books, and now we are at a point where there's over 187,000 pages of regulatory text in the Code of Federal Regulations. If you were to try to read that as your full-time job, reading about 250 words per minute, it would, as of today, as of this morning, it would take you 3 years, 111 days, 6 hours, and 6 minutes to read through all regulations that are on the books right now. 1970, I think I said 40,000, the number was actually 50,000. It would have taken you about 1 year to read through all the regulations were on the books that were on the books. So that's phenomenal. That's phenomenal in the sense that that's a phenomenon that's worth remarking upon. The growth of regulation is very real and seems to be inexorable. The average growth rate we've seen since 1970, about 2.1% per year. That is to say, the number of regulations on the books grows by about 2.1% every year. The number was higher back in the 1970s when we saw the creation of some powerful social regulators like EPA, but it's still been a relatively constant growth rate over the entire time period, with the exception of 2017. That was an oddball year. We can come back to that later on. But this study was done before 2017 had occurred. So why did we want to do this study? We saw regulatory accumulation. We just ran over some of the numbers. And me as an economist and my co-authors were concerned about what this could be doing to growth. So how specifically could regulatory accumulation be affecting economic growth? Well, it's through the mechanism that Devin mentioned earlier. It's affecting businesses. And in the long run, think about economic growth. There's been an evolution over time in economics. There was a focus early on in economics of studying populations and how populations can lead to economic growth, and then evolved into looking at capital and labor more specifically, and some models got better and better. But over time, we eventually realized as a profession that long-run growth comes from productivity gains. It comes from using the resources that you have more efficiently for better growth. And those productivity gains come not just randomly. They're from deliberate business investment. But this could be new businesses that are forming because they see some opportunity to do things differently or create some new product. This could be our research and development from existing businesses or expansion of existing businesses, or even renewal of machinery or other sorts of capital that existing businesses use that maybe lead them to become more efficient or more productive. All these are the sorts of business changes, business investments that lead to productivity gains that in the long run is the driver of economic growth. So we were concerned as a research team about how regulation and regulatory accumulation could be affecting business investment. And there's a few easy ways to think about how this could be regulation could be affecting investment. The most obvious one is compliance costs. When new regulations are created, businesses that choose to comply, which let's just assume is by and large most or all of them, will have to incur some costs. And those costs, of course, can then not be spent. Whatever spent on compliance can't then be spent on things like R&D or expansion. There's some more subtle effects, though. One is from the fact that regulation, by design, will prohibit some activities. So there's just certain things that you can no longer do. Sometimes it's unintentional prohibitions. There will be, for example, there's a history of regulations sometimes being very prescriptive in how they tell businesses to comply with a certain problem or certain regulation that's supposed to solve a problem. Here's an example. Several decades ago, the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, outlawed by regulation supersonic flights over the continental U.S. Now, that's a very specific design standard that then all manufacturers had to follow. But when you think about the problem there, it's not necessarily that planes are going fast. So this is a rule that addresses indirectly a problem by saying you can't go above some certain speed. The speed happens to be the sound barrier. But the problem was that breaking the sound barrier over cities is sometimes disturbing. Perhaps there's concerns about safety. The regulations could have been crafted in a way that addressed the actual problems rather than creating a broad design standard. But that design standard has persisted and it's prohibited research into faster and faster passenger planes. So prohibitions can be long-lasting. There can be some path dependency that makes them persist and makes those certain areas of the sector, or excuse me, those certain sectors of the economy never even develop because, well, they're prohibited. And then finally, an even more subtle way in which regulations and the buildup of regulations can affect growth is through sheer complexity and how the uncertainty that that can create. And I think this is fairly obvious once you think about how many rules are on the books. You know, if it would take you over 3 years to read regulations, how can you, if you were a business owner, be certain about what actions or activities might be currently prohibited or might skirt the law barely or are at risk of being regulated in the future? The growth of rules and how rules could be interpreted or reinterpreted could lead business people to choose not to enter certain spaces entirely because of uncertainty or complexity. So those are the drivers in our model of how regulatory accumulation could be, in fact, affecting business investment and therefore affecting economic growth. So to briefly summarize the model that we're working with here, and by the way, if you have looked at the paper, it does have a pretty rigorous growth model. The family of growth models this is taken from is called endogenous growth. And basically, endogenous growth models means what I said earlier, where growth isn't assumed to be an accident. Instead, it's a result of deliberate business investment that leads to productivity gains, which drives economic growth. So we have this endogenous growth model in which regulations affect business investment, and then those investments in our model are what lead to innovation, productivity gains. And because regulation can either distort or deter business investment, either into compliance, sometimes into lobbying, sometimes into bad ideas, sometimes just force money to stay on the sidelines rather than be invested, our model captures how regulations can be affecting innovation by doing those, by distorting those investments, altering those investment choices of businesses. And then finally, once we've captured that, once we've understood better how regulations are affecting business investments and therefore affecting productivity, growth, and innovation, we capture that effect back in our model by seeing how the foregone innovation, the foregone productivity growth, slows overall economic growth. And that's, we're able to do that because we do have a model of the economy. Now, a big part of the paper is spent showing the reader just how well this model of the economy works. That's important to do because, well, it is science. We want to assure the reader that this is the effects that we're finding here are likely the effects. Excuse me, between the relationship between regulations and business investment is actually going to have some sort of effect on long run growth. And we're able to do that because we're able to show how business investments do actually affect long-run growth in our model. So the challenges we face going into this, we wanted to be scientific and rigorous. There really had not been any study of the effect of regulatory accumulation that was scientific and rigorous, that was comprehensive in the way that it measured regulation, that used some measurement of regulation that was objective and replicable, and perhaps, maybe not most importantly, but equally importantly, that had some way of running an experiment. So let me expound on this for a little bit. If you think about science and the scientific method, the easiest way to consider an experiment in science is think about rats being tested with some sort of drug, and you have a control group and you have an experiment group, and you want to make sure that there's multiple groups. If you only have an experiment group, then you have no control group to compare it to, and so you don't get to see what the drug being tested actually does. You have no basis for comparison. We really needed that control group, and that was one of the big innovations in this study. Because we were able to build a economic model that did a very good job of predicting economic growth, of showing how different components of the economy, in particular business investment, would affect economic growth, we are able to run a pseudo-experiment, run a simulation of what would happen in different scenarios under of regulatory accumulation, with more or less accumulation. So that was a really important innovation here. And then a second related innovation here was we're able to have multiple groups because the data, which I'm going to talk about momentarily, let us separate regulation into the different industries that are being targeted by regulation. So let me jump into that. We'll have plenty of time, I think, to go back and talk about the model if you want to, but let me just briefly summarize the model. Is basically we have a good model of the economy, and in that model, productivity gains are the drivers of growth, and productivity gains are the result of business investments, and we want to see how regulation in our model affects those business investments. So let's talk about regulation and the data we used to put into the model as our measurement of regulation. Devin mentioned at the outset here that I lead a team here at Mercatus working on something called the RegData Project. Some of you may have heard of RegData, but if not, RegData is both a methodology and a database. It is a consequence of the fact that we needed to go through 180,000 plus pages of regulation and didn't have 3 years plus to spend doing it. So in short, we wrote some programs to do it for us. So RegData is a set of computer programs that go and read regulations on our behalf and pluck out, if you will, certain keywords and phrases that let us measure how much regulation there is at a given point in time and see how regulation has grown over time. So this was a direct answer to one of the challenges we faced going into this, which was that there existed no good metric of regulation that was comprehensive and objective. RegData filled that void. RegData yields a couple of important variables, a couple of important metrics of regulation. One is the quantity of regulatory restrictions. How many words like shall, must, or may not are on the books at a point in time? And remember, regulations by design either create prohibitions, as I discussed earlier, or sometimes obligations to do certain things. And typically, as you all surely know, they do this with these words like shall or must. So we count those up and measure those up, and the total restriction count does move in a very highly correlated manner to the total page count, although it's not exact, not perfectly correlated. We've got actually over 1 million regulatory restrictions on the books right now, in case you're wondering. And that growth has also, just like pages, has been consistently going up over time. The growth rate's been pretty steady at around 2% over time. The other thing that RegData lets us do is figure out which industries or sectors of the economy are being targeted by those shalls and those musts, those regulatory restrictions. We do this with a little bit of artificial intelligence on the part of the programs. We teach the programs how to identify language or regulation that is about specific industries with some machine learning algorithms. So in summary, not to get too deep into this, although I'd be happy to afterward, we feed our programs a bunch of documents that we know are about specific industries. The program reads all those documents, learns what words and phrases are important to identify specific industries, also learns what words and phrases aren't about those industries, and then once it's learned that, it can go and read all the hundreds of thousands of pages of regulations, and we're going back to 1970, so it is actually well into the millions of pages of regulations, and tell us which industries are being targeted by which chunks of text. So those two things, restrictions and the industry relevance of those restrictions, lets us make this really rich data set. It covers a bunch of industries of the economy over time. And at the time we were doing this study, it went from 1977 to 2012. We've since the database has since grown. We now go back to 1970 and through 2016 as of last year. So that's reg data, and that was our data solution. And it was really the way without reg data we would not have been able to do this study, to be perfectly blunt. And so it's important to dwell on it for a bit. And in fact, reg data was created for the purpose of doing this study. Later on, we realized reg data is great for a bunch of other stuff, but we wanted first and foremost to be able to do this study. And so once we had reg data built, we had this this nice model of the economy. We had this nice metric of regulation, how it grows over time for different industries. We had good data for a bunch of different industries, specifically 22 different industries. We had data on business investment by industry. We had industry-specific production costs. We had national data, such as the overall size of the economy, demographic data. All these different data went into our model, and then out of that, we're able to run our model and understand how regulation, as measured by reg data, does indeed affect business investment in all these different industries. And we can compare within this some industries which are relatively more regulated, or for which the growth of regulation is growing faster for some than for others. I remember earlier I was talking about science and having different groups. This is key here. Being able to compare industries that are relatively more regulated or more quickly regulated to those that are relatively less regulated or more slowly regulated really lets us understand how regulation does indeed affect the choices of businesses within these more or less regulated industries. Without that variation across industries, it would be much harder to identify the effect here. And once we identify that effect of regulation on business investment across these different industries over this 36 years of data for which we were able to run our model, we went back and ran a counterfactual experiment. And so this was why we needed that model. We wanted to go back and say, all right, what would have happened in an alternative world, a world in which regulatory accumulation didn't occur? And so for our experiment, we said, what would have happened if we'd paused the growth of regulation at the levels we observed in 1980? And what that specifically means if you imagine regulation growing over time, imagine a graph, and it's pretty much just a line that's going up as you go from left to right. And on the left side is year 1970, on the far right is the current year, and there's just a line that goes up. Instead of continuing to go up at year 1980, it just stops going up and becomes a straight line moving to the right. So that was our alternative world, a world in which regulation didn't go away, it just paused at the level we observed in 1980. And we re-ran our model under that scenario. And the results were pretty astounding. The average annual growth rate would have been nearly 1% higher. It's 0.8 of a percentage point higher. That may not sound like much, but when you think about growth right now, we're finally getting back up to growth that's above 3% or at 3%. If you add on 0.8 of a percent, that'd be 3.8%, or back in the days before we got above 3%, it could be the difference between, slogging along at 2% and getting close to 3% growth. 0.8 is a big deal, especially when you're talking about repeated year after year after year. So growth from last year adds to growth this year, adds to growth next year. Growth is an exponential process. And so if you go back and do this for 30-plus years, the end result is the economy would have been about 25% larger by year 2012 than it actually was in this counterfactual experiment. To put that in dollar terms, that means the economy would have been about $4 trillion larger in 2012 than it actually was at $13,000 per person. So that's a pretty big deal. If you were to put that in terms of how big that number is, $4 trillion compared to just economies around the world, that would be the fourth largest economy in the world in the year 2012. That's the lost growth from regulatory accumulation would have been the fourth largest economy. So that's pretty big. And remember, a couple other final points here to wrap up. We're just talking about federal regulations here. It's all that went into the study. We're not even considering state regulations, local regulations. Those, of course, matter as well. We are increasingly able to measure those. Reg data has expanded into the states. We have some numbers from over 20 states now available on our website. And so hopefully at some point we'll be able to better understand how state regulations and maybe even at some point local regulations, ordinances, those sorts of things can affect growth as well. And we're also not considering things like guidance documents, interpretations, memoranda. So all of those might be other factors in the regulatory state that could be affecting growth as well. So I'd say this is probably a conservative estimate, but the bottom line here is when we get focused, and this happens a lot in policy circles, get focused on compliance costs, get focused on upfront fixed costs that are associated with new regulations, you kind of lose sight of the fact that, well, there's the real cost of regulatory accumulation is what we don't see. It's the growth that we don't achieve because people aren't starting new businesses or people aren't going into some certain areas because regulations are just too heavy in that area. There's too much uncertainty. This study shines a light on that portion of the cost of regulatory accumulation, and it's huge. $4 trillion by far outweighs any other sort of estimate that we've seen of the sum of, for example, compliance costs across all regulations. So I'll wrap up there and leave plenty of time for questions, I hope. But, I think that this is a study that going forward, this will be coming out in a journal. We're working on our revisions for that, so we can talk about that if you want as well. And we're, of course, following up on this study, both in the sense of creating more data sets and using the same model in other circumstances, and so we could talk about that as well. Devin, I'll turn it back over to you.
Wonderful. Thanks for those remarks, Patrick. As you mentioned, I think we should go to audience questions now. So in a moment, everyone on the call is going to hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, all you have to do is enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. Let's do that. Okay, the floor mode is on. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then you can ask your question. We'll answer all the questions in the order in which we receive them. Again, to ask a question, all you need to do is enter star and then the pound button on your telephone keypad. We have some questions now, so we'll go to our first caller.
Hi, just a quick question. I see that there is an April 2016 study that you did on the cumulative cost of regulations. Is that what you're referring to, or is there something newer than that?
No, that is the one I'm referring to.
Okay, but there's going to be an updated one. Is that what you're saying?
There's, excuse me, I'm working on another study with the same co-authors where it's not exactly an update of this same study. That's something we might do as well, but this what I'm about to talk about is more advanced. Instead, we're studying British Columbia, of all places. So this, the province in Canada that you wouldn't really expect to be the hotbed or pioneer of regulatory reform actually has been. British Columbia has been following a form of a regulatory budget for over 15 years, and as a result, the number of regulatory restrictions on the books gone down, depending on what point in time you want to look at, either by over a third to almost by 50%. And so instead of have to run some sort of counterfactual simulated experiment like I talked about earlier, we can actually observe what happened in British Columbia when they did cut regulations by that much. So we're using the same sort of endogenous growth model there. We're using the same way of measuring regulation, counting up regulatory restrictions for each industry, and seeing how that has affected the growth of the province overall, as well as specific industries there. So that's our follow-up study. It's not ready for release yet, but I expect it to probably come out in the first half of this year.
Great. I'll look forward to reading both papers. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for the question. I want to say that we've got an announcement as well. Tomorrow, Wednesday, January 24th, at 12 o'clock noon, we have a free lunch podcast, and we'll be joined by former counselor to the administrator of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, Paul Noe, and Deputy Associate Attorney General at the U.S. Department of Justice, Stephen Cox. Paul and Steve will address the proper and improper use of guidance documents by regulatory agencies and the many developments that we've seen in this space within the last year. So Patrick made some allusion to the fact that they're not studying or at least quantifying perhaps the potential drag on the economy of these sorts of sub-regulatory, what's been called dark matter. But we'll be talking about that tomorrow on a teleforum, Wednesday, January 24th, 12 o'clock noon. We'll go to our next question now.
Hi, this is Tom Watson in Los Angeles. I was curious, you were going to mention something about what's happened in 2017 and also perhaps what Naomi Rao, if I'm pronouncing her name right, has done on the deregulatory front. Really look forward to your comments.
Sure. Thanks for the question. It's a good one, and I did hint at it. So, of course, the Trump administration and Naomi Rao have taken on the regulatory state, or at least talked about it, right? And the data that we've been creating here in the Reg Data Project and in the QuantGov Project let us actually get past the rhetoric, let's say. So it's easy to say that they're going through deregulation, but by and large, we actually haven't seen a decrease in the quantity of regulations on the books. What we have seen is a tremendous slowdown in the rate of growth of regulation. So it's not just rhetoric. The average rate of growth for regulation from 1970 through 2016, as I mentioned earlier, is about 2.1% annually. In 2017, that rate went down to about 0.65%, so let's call it 0.7%. So one-third of the average growth rate that we've seen. And that also is significantly lower than the rate of growth that we've seen in the first year of any president for which we have data. So Ford, Carter, Reagan, both Bushes, Clinton, and Obama, all of those presidents oversaw a regulatory state that grew much faster than the regulatory state grew under President Trump. But, you know, notably, it still grew. It's still a positive growth rate. The next closest to Trump's numbers are 0.65. The next closest first year numbers, George W. Bush, was 1.66%. So it's a big difference. And in case you're wondering, Reagan's first year, 1981, was 4.8% growth. So it... I think the lesson here is, you know, the Trump administration really is doing something. Through executive orders, through placement of appointees, they are affecting the regulatory state and its growth rate. I wouldn't call it quite a dismantling or a deregulatory trend, at least not yet, but it's certainly different from trends we've seen in the past. And if you think that Reagan oversaw a growth rate of 4.8% in his first year, that indicates it's a hard thing to do. It's hard to change the direction, the momentum that the regulatory state has. So it might require some patience.
Thanks for the question and great answer, Patrick. I'm going to make another call for questions here. I don't see any currently queued up. After I do so, if we don't have any questions, I'll ask Patrick if he has any closing remarks. Again, if you need to or if you'd like to ask a question, just please enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad and we'll get to you. Give us a second.
Devin, in the meantime, can I chime in real quick about guidance documents? So you mentioned them earlier, and we were just talking about President Trump and his reforms in his first year in office. You know, he's created this, through executive order, a one-in-two-out sort of ethos within the agencies, at least the executive branch agencies. And if you think about, basic economics tell us when one activity gets harder to do, people may substitute another activity. And the same applies in the regulatory sphere. If it becomes harder to actually create new regulations, but you as a regulator view your job as you need to make more rules, maybe you'll try to find alternative paths to making rules. And that could be backdoor rulemaking, stealth rulemaking, dark matter, whatever you want to call it. Using guidance documents or reinterpretations to effectively create rules might be an alternative path. So it's something to keep an eye on. You know, I think people are aware of the temptation to turn from using rulemakings to using interpretations and guidance documents, but it's going to get probably larger and more tempting over time as if the Trump administration is able to really change the culture, really change the ways in which agencies go about making new rules.
Yeah, thanks for commenting on that, Patrick. Again, one of the reasons why this has come up is that we have another free lunch podcast teleforum tomorrow at noon that will be discussing this particular issue and how guidance documents have been used to essentially make new law and new regulation, how they actually should be used, what the proper and improper use of those guidance documents are, and what, for example, the Department of Justice has done to halt the improper use of guidance documents. That'll be tomorrow with a representative from the Justice Department and Paul Noe, who authored the Good Guidance Practices Bulletin when he was at the Office of Management and Budget. Seeing no more questions, Patrick, thanks again for your comments. Do you have any final remarks that you'd like to give to our callers?
Well, I mentioned earlier British Columbia, and we've talked about the reforms that the Trump administration has started. And I think a good way of summarizing what we've learned from both British Columbia and the experiment that's ongoing right now in D.C. is that, well, to put it in the very, very wise and kind of silly-sounding words of a former student, regulators regulate. It's what they do. They view it as their job to make new rules or more rules, and that's been the tradition for decades in America, and that's why we've seen regulatory accumulation over time. If you want to stop that from occurring, you have to change the mindset of regulators to make them, instead of view themselves as rule makers, instead view themselves as rule managers, where their goal is to optimize on some portfolio of rules. That includes looking back and seeing what rules aren't working, aren't very effective. And that's a change in culture. That's a change in the way regulators view themselves. It's a change that was accomplished in British Columbia. In fact, that phrase, rule, going from rule makers to rule managers, came out of the early years in the British Columbia experiment. And it got buy-in from the regulators themselves, from the people working at the agencies. So if that sort of change can occur here in Washington, then we may actually see over time a shift away from regulatory accumulation to something more like a steady state. Deregulation may be another hurdle altogether, but any sort of progress has to go through changing the mindset of regulators.
Wonderful. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, I want to thank our audience and, of course, Patrick for joining us on the Free Lunch Podcast today. And until tomorrow, when we have another one, so long, everyone.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to Free Lunch. As always, you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play to get new episodes of Free Lunch when they're published. Also, visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org. There, we regularly upload content in addition to our podcasts, such as short videos and papers. And you can join the discussion by sharing your story of how regulation has personally affected you. Until next time, remember, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.